what he had imagined it to be. And when he got back, became an opponent of the war. He also started writing and has written poetry about his experiences in Vietnam. And he's also the author of an autobiographical trilogy, a series of three books about his experiences in Vietnam and after. The third of these books was just published this summer. And we'll talk about that and about Vietnam more generally with Bill Earhart this morning. The three books are, the first one is Vietnam Perkasie, and Perkasie was the town in Pennsylvania when he grew up. The first book, Vietnam Perkasie, A Combat Marine Memoir. The second, Passing Time, Memoir of a Vietnam Veteran Against the War. And that book has just come out in paperback, published by the University of Massachusetts Press. And the third book, which is also published by University of Massachusetts Press, it's out now in hardcover, and that title of that book is Busted, A Vietnam Veteran in Nixon's America. He was decorated for his service in Vietnam. He received the Purple Heart, two presidential unit citations, the Cross of Gallantry. He was promoted to sergeant and was honorably discharged. His first published work appeared in Winning Hearts and Minds, War Poems by Vietnam Veterans. And since then, his writing has appeared in periodicals including the Virginia Quarterly Review, the American Poetry Review, USA Today, the Philadelphia Inquirer, and the Utney Reader. He now makes his home in Pennsylvania and is joining us this morning by telephone. And if you have questions, comments, you want to join the conversation at any point, that's welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. It's good anywhere you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Or if you match up the numbers and letters, you get WILL. So it's 333-WILL and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Mr. Earhart, hello.
Hello, good morning.
How are you doing?
Just fine.
Pleased that you could talk with us today.
Well, I'm pleased to be on the show.
You, as I mentioned, you joined the Marines. You enlisted when you were 17 years old and went through basic training and then went to Vietnam. What led you to enlist in the Marines at that age and at that time?
Well, let's see. How much time do we have here?
Only 50 minutes.
It took me about 35 pages in my first book to go through the whole thing. Let me try to make a long story short.
Okay.
I grew up in, by the way, I don't mean to embarrass you, but the name of the town I grew up in is Perkasie.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Well, it's a very common mispronunciation.
Perkasie. Okay.
But this is was a small rural community in eastern Pennsylvania, about 5,000 people, surrounded by small family farms, and it's gotten quite suburbanized now, but 35 years ago when I was growing up, it really was a little country town, staunchly Republican. The entire, my father's generation were all in a National Guard unit that got called up at the same time in the Second World War, and they all trooped off to Europe and got captured in the Battle of the Bulge and spent the last 4 months of the war in a prison camp and came home and joined the American Legion and marched on Memorial Day every year. And I mean, this was the kind of atmosphere I grew up in, a very red, white, and blue, patriotic community that when I came along in the mid 60s, when the war in Vietnam was beginning to heat up, the assumption was simply that if we were engaged there, then obviously the Vietnamese must have a problem, and it was our duty to solve that problem for them. There were also some personal factors involved. I was a minister's kid. I was the third child of a local minister. Our family was, as those things go in small towns, our family was very visible and very prominent. And whatever I did with my life, my older brothers had already done, including go to college. So here was something I could do that they had not yet done. Mm. I don't think that was my conscious thinking at the time, but in looking back on it, clearly that had much to do with it. This was also my chance to win medals and be a hero. I was a little guy. The Marine Corps is full of little guys. I got beat up when I was a kid several times, and I can remember running away, publicly debasing myself rather than getting beat up again. And, of course, you know, the Marine Corps builds men. That was the recruiting slogan in those days. And so I was going to be a man. The Marine Corps was going to teach me how to defend myself, and I would never get beat up again. And all the girls would flock to my uniform. And, you know, there were all these wonderful personal things that were going to accrue to me by joining the Marines. But underlying all of that was an absolute and fundamental belief in the rightness of my country, in the rightness of my government. If Lyndon Johnson said that we needed to fight the communists in Vietnam, that was good enough for me. Mm. And it was good enough for my teachers and my parents, and you know, the whole community really supported this notion.
Although I guess I get the impression from Busted that when you talk about how your parents reacted after you had enlisted, that actually they weren't very happy.
Well, no, but the rationale was not on any kind of political or ideological or moral basis. It was a simple matter of, you know, if you're a parent, do you want your kid to go to the Marines and go to war, or do you want your kid to go to college?
Yeah.
It was that simple. I mean, and as I finally, you know, what finally sealed the decision, because I was 17, my parents had to give their written consent. And what finally did it, in some frustration, my mother remembers very vividly my saying to her after a several hour heated discussion, blurting out, "Is this the way you raised me to let other mother's sons fight America's wars?"
Hmm.
And that was the end of the discussion. She said there was nothing she could say to that, because that's not how she had raised us.
Well, after you got to Vietnam and had been there for a while, how long did it take before you started to question the rightness of the war and the rightness of American troops for being there?
Well, it took me 3 days to figure out that something was wrong. The third day I was there, there was an incident that happened where some of the grunts, some of the infantrymen, came in on amphibious tractors with a group of what were called detainees. These were not prisoners of war. They had not been captured with weapons. They were civilians who were detained for questioning. And they came roaring into the battalion compound on two amphibious tractors. And before the tracks actually stopped, the grunts up on top began throwing people down. Now, these are people with bound hand and foot, and an Amtrak sits up. The top of it is a good 8 or 9 feet off the ground. So these were folks who were landing on their heads, on their sides, on their shoulders. You could actually hear bones snapping, and it was a collection of old men and women and children. And I watched this. I grabbed the guy next to me, who was an old salt of maybe 19 years age, but he'd been in Vietnam for about 10 months at that point. And I was quite shocked. I grabbed a hold of him, and I said, "Jimmy, what are these guys doing? These are civilians." He turned to me with this flat, blank expression on his face, and in an absolutely expressionless voice said, "Earhart, you'd better keep your mouth shut and your eyes open until you know what's going on around here." That's all he said.
Hmm.
And so at that point, I'm thinking, uh-oh, maybe there's more going on here than I realize. From there on, it was a long, slow process. I mean, a number of little incidents like that. There was no one My Lai massacre that I witnessed, or you know, a particular point at which I suddenly realized, uh-oh. Rather, it was this long accumulation of little things that by the summer of 67, I got there in February of 67, and by the middle of that summer, I had come to the conclusion that the war was crazy. I didn't know what was going on. What I did know that it was not what Lyndon Johnson had told me. It was not what my high school history teachers had told me. It was not what I was reading in Time magazine. And I got Time magazine every week. I had a subscription. So I could read what Dean Rusk was saying, and I could read what Robert McNamara was saying. And I literally remember sitting there reading these guys and looking out over the berm at the Vietnamese countryside and thinking to myself, what planet are these men on?
Hmm.
What are these guys talking about? Not the war I'm in. Now, I couldn't figure out what was going on All I knew was what was happening was crazy. The Vietnamese civilians that we were there to help clearly did not want our help. They were, if anything, they were neutral to hostile. I mean, there was just incident after incident that was clear that we were not wanted there. And all I wanted to do was get the hell out and go home. I knew, as all the soldiers who went to Vietnam knew, I knew the day that I would leave if I were still alive. I knew that on March the 5th, 1968, I could go home. And so from my sole purpose was simply to stay alive in order to go home. It was not until well after I left Vietnam, you know, my theory was, I was thinking, just get the heck out of here and then it's somebody else's problem. What I discovered again over a period of another more than a year after I left, really 2 years after I left Vietnam, was that it was still my problem, that I had brought it home with me, that I slept with it, that it never went away, and that I needed to figure out what the hell was going on. It was actually Kent State, the killings at Kent State, which finally forced me to realize this war is not going away and it's my problem and I'd better do something. And at that point I began to try to understand what had happened to me individually, but in the process to what had happened to my country. And I stumbled upon the actual history of the war in Vietnam. And that's when things began to make sense. It was a terrible kind of sense-making, but at least things made sense. The reason why I couldn't understand what was happening to me in Vietnam when I was there is that, to give you a metaphor, it was as though they had given me a deck of cards and told me to play solitaire until I won. And I kept trying to play, and I couldn't win, and I couldn't win. And only after the fact did I discover that my government had given me a deck with 37 cards in it. And not only did they give me a deck with 37 cards in it, but they told me this is a full deck. In the process of going out and collecting the other cards to give me a real full deck, it was that missing information which I needed, without which I couldn't make sense of what I had actually been witnessing. Things like that Ho Chi Minh had come to Versailles in 1919 expecting that Woodrow Wilson would live up to his 14 points, one of which was, you know, self-determination for all peoples and all nations, that South Vietnam was invented by the Western powers at a conference in Geneva in 1954. I didn't know that. I didn't know that Ho Chi Minh was considered the father of his country by Northerners and Southerners alike. What I didn't know could fill a book, and in fact, I did fill a book with what I didn't know. The second book that I wrote, Passing Time, deals with this process of making sense of my own experiences and by extension, making sense of the history of the war and of my own country's history.
You know, certainly people who have written about the war as you have, I think, have made a lot of the same points, particularly about the nature of this war and the difficulty of knowing who the enemy was. And I'm thinking about there in Busted, right at the in the introduction, there's one of your poems, and I won't read the whole thing, but there's one verse that's at the opening and then near the end, and that is, it's practically impossible to tell civilians from the Viet Cong, and the very last two lines of the poem are, after a while, you quit trying.
Yes.
And I think that really brings out the point, you know, some of the points that you were just making. One thing I wonder, though, is whether some of your feelings are the way anybody would feel having been in a war, and how much of it really is about Vietnam. And so I sort of wonder, I don't know if you've thought about this, but if, for example, you had fought in World War II or in Korea, whether you might have some of the same feelings that you do about Vietnam, so that some of that has to do with being in combat, but some of it really does have to do with Vietnam and the fact that that war was different.
Well, undoubtedly, as I have gotten older, I have begun to understand just how similar the experience of modern battle is, depending, disregarding the particulars of any given war. This is something actually that I feel some bitterness about, that my father's generation really sent their children off to Vietnam without ever really telling them what the hell to expect. There are all sorts of cultural reasons for that. World War II was the good war, and you know, it's not polite to say nasty things about that war, and complain about how stupid and brutal and inhumane it was. You know, we were the good guys and we won. But in fact, a lot of information has begun to surface. I particularly recommend Paul Fussell's book, Wartime, which really debunks a lot of the mythology of the Second World War, and for which Fussell got a lot of flack because, you know, he's gored a number of sacred cows in our culture. But he, in there, not explicitly, but if implicitly, makes it very clear that his experiences and the experiences of soldiers in the Second World War were just as brutal and ugly and unsettling as were the experiences of soldiers in Vietnam. That was not clear in the 60s and 70s when guys were, when post-traumatic stress disorder first became a public topic, and we were perceived as whiners and losers, and we couldn't bear up under the rigors of battle the way our daddies did, and of course all that turns out to be bull. War, modern war, where skill at arms and bravery and training basically have very little to do with what actually happens to you on the field of battle. Once we reach that point in roughly the middle of the 19th century, then the stress of battle became fairly predictable. And what happens to soldiers is very similar from one war to another. However, I think the main difference, there are two main differences with the war in Vietnam. One is that the war dragged on and on and on with nothing that resembled progress. And this, if you think back, went on for a good 5 years, much longer than American participation in the Second World War, and with no semblance of motion. Whereas in the Second World War, we conquered North Africa, and then we invaded Italy, and then we invaded France, and you could see a sense of progress being made. And the other thing that is so particular about Vietnam is the lengths of duplicity that the government went to, the overt and deliberate and systematic lying day after day, week after week, month after month, year after year. And if anyone doubts, what I'm saying, just go find the Pentagon Papers and read them. It's all in there, and this is not a document written by some left-wing pinko commie. This was prepared at the order of Robert McNamara himself. And of course now, 20 some years later, McNamara comes out and goes, "Oh, it was wrong, terribly wrong," but like he's telling me something I don't know, that I didn't know that when I was an 18-year-old PFC. All he's done is to confirm what I knew years ago, that they were all lying to us. This is the Secretary of Defense who knew that the war was not winnable and never said a word to anybody except maybe his wife in the middle of the night in bed. And that's where, a guy who went through the Second World War, read Eugene Sledge's book, With the Old Breed, and it's an astounding account of the island campaigns in the Pacific. Horrible stuff that these guys had to go through. But at the bottom line to all that was, but if I had not suffered what I had suffered, where would the world be now? The Japanese would control the Pacific, and the Germans would control Europe and Africa. One can see that those terrible sacrifices were for some purpose. Whereas soldiers who fought in Vietnam, whether you think that the war was absolutely wrong or you think we should have nuked Hanoi, no matter how you feel, you look at what's there now and what was it worth? Nothing. Absolutely nothing. So that what I call that psychological pillow has been removed from the soldiers who fought in Vietnam. And, of course, in the absence of that, what you get is all kinds of odd thinking. And I know I'm going to get flack from other Vietnam veterans who are listening to this program now, but it is the origin of the MIA myth, that somehow they've still got our boys over there in bamboo cages, and people who are disaffected with the way the war went have put enormous amounts of energy into that issue because it's a way of not letting go. The tremendous animosity among a great many Vietnam veterans, resistance to normalizing relations with Vietnam, this notion of punishing them because they had the audacity to beat us. The idea that the resurrection of the notion that somehow this really was a noble cause, the whole phenomenon of, well, we could have won if only they'd have let us fight to win, which is a chilling echo of the stab-in-the-back theory that the German people and the German army developed in the wake of the First World War, and which led directly to the rise of Adolf Hitler. And when I listen to people talk about how we could have won the war if only they'd have let us fight to win, it just sends chills down my spine, because I don't know how much more we could have done to that country besides obliterate every last man, woman, and child in it. The notion that we somehow were fighting with one hand tied behind our back simply does not bear up under scrutiny.
Our guest is Bill Earhart, and by the way, if you go looking for his books, he uses his initials, WD, so look for WD Earhart, and that's Earhart. He is a poet. His work has appeared in a number of places, including Virginia Quarterly Review, the American Poetry Review, USA Today, Philadelphia Inquirer, the Utney Reader, and is the author of a trilogy, an autobiographical trilogy, series of three books about his experiences in Vietnam and after. The first book is Vietnam Percussy, is that right?
Yes.
Vietnam Percussy, that's the town he grew up in, Pennsylvania, a combat Marine memoir. The second book, Passing Time, Memoir of a Vietnam Veteran Against the War. And the third book, which is just came out this summer, is Busted, a Vietnam Veteran in Nixon's America, University of Massachusetts Press, the publisher. And actually, we really haven't talked about that particular book very much, and I hope we'll get the chance to do that. But we also have several callers, so I want to bring them into the show as well. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL, by the way, the numbers. First caller here in Clifton, line 4. Hello.
Yes. I'm a World War II veteran. I served a little time in the Pacific with the 5th Air Force. And the first thing I want to say, and the most important thing I want to say, is you call this fellow, you call yourself WD?
Right.
Right.
What is it?
That's what I publish under my initials.
WD. Okay. Well, the first thing I want to say to you is thank you for serving our country, and I didn't listen to the first part of the program, and I know there's controversy going on and on and on, but it just chills me that there are 58,000, last I knew, there were 58,183 names on the wall, and I think they've corrected that to 58,196, do you know?
Well, I know they keep adding, they've added a few names over the years. I think when it originally was published, it was 57-something, but...
It's up to 58,000.
Yeah, it's over 58 now.
196, maybe. But anyway, you said earlier something about a good war. There are no good wars. We lost 292,131 in combat. And to me, a veteran is a veteran. I don't care where they served and when. I'm extremely sorry for the treatment that you people got. It wasn't me, and I'm not trying to absolve myself, but the way the public thought about this, I just thought it was terrible, because you guys were out there doing a job, and I think you did help stem the communistic, whatever the word is, but anyway... I'm glad that WILL has put you on here today, and I think maybe they ought to have more of us on there from time to time. That's basically what I called it, just to say thank you. And I think that I was so proud when the Americans came forward in Desert Storm with the patriotism that they had, but they should have showed that to you fellas, too. That's really all I have to say. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks for the call. Bill, you got any reaction of any sort to...
Oh, gee, I haven't. It seems cruel to respond in the way that I feel like I appreciate the gentleman's thanks, but I mean, I frankly think I've served my country much better since I got out of the Marines and started writing about what was wrong with that war than I ever did while I was wearing a uniform. Of course, I have heard the argument that somehow, you know, we might have lost the war in Vietnam, but you know, that was one battle in a larger war that we have finally won, and look, the Soviet Union has collapsed, so that proves that it was all worth it. I think you can play all sorts of games with history. That it's simply one person's opinion against another, but I said I appreciate the gentleman's thanks, but I think it's probably misplaced. I don't know that I'm not at all convinced that I ever did anything well in uniform that I deserve to be thanked for. I certainly did my duty as the government defined that duty, but I think that we were pretty ill served by our government. I also would like to comment on the fact that I'm not quite sure what the gentleman means by the kind of treatment we got, but you know, that's one of the great myths of the Vietnam War, is that we all got spit on and called baby killer when we came home. That never happened to me. It simply didn't happen to me, and I actually returned to the United States twice in uniform, once in March of 68 from Vietnam and once in June of 69 from another overseas assignment. And that simply did not happen to me. And when I got involved in the anti-war movement, no one around me, I never heard anyone say those kinds of things or do those kinds of things to soldiers that they encountered. I think that's largely a mythology that has been created for very base political purposes after the fact. And I know a lot of veterans who, you know, they'll look me right in the eye and say, it really happened to me. I was really spit on. And I frankly, it's difficult again, but I don't believe them. I believe that's how they felt. I think they felt sort of shabby and abused. And you start telling this story, you know, boy, I heard about this guy who got off the plane at Fort Lewis, and he was, you know, there was a mob waiting for him, and he was spit on. And, you know, and as you tell and retell the story, I heard about this guy becomes, well, this happened to me. And in fact, psychologists will tell you that people can convince themselves that things happened which didn't really happen. That's not at all an unusual phenomenon. But all I can say is it certainly was not part of my experience. Certainly I wasn't given a big parade in Percy or anything like that, but you know, I wasn't abused by the American people when I came back, and that they should feel ambivalent about the war and the soldiers is not in the least bit surprising, since you know, it wasn't a clear-cut situation. And why I should expect more out of, you know, somehow a clarity of thinking from the general American public when the government itself had no clarity in its own thinking. It's just not reasonable to expect that.
Well, I think that the last call, let's talk with somebody else in Taylorville next, line one. Hello?
Yeah, hi. Mm-hmm. I was just remembering Randolph Bourne and one of his clever observations about war and nations in general. It was a zippy one-liner, I thought. It still rings true about Nam and lots of other places. War is the health of the state, he wrote. It seems to me that a great deal of what was going on back then and is still going on in the name of politics, domestic as well as foreign policy, could be summed up under the elegant little phrase "thought control." It's still a basic it's a basic style of American. Of American life, and most of us seem to buy into it pretty well, although we're not too infatuated with the way things are going. We're rather infatuated. It's kind of schizophrenic, I think. We're rather fond of. We hate it, but we love it. I think that war really was a racist war. I don't think we'd have fought. We would have if this had been in Europe. I don't think it would have been fought the same way. And I frankly believe that we were willing to kill 10 civilians or thereabouts for every so-called enemy soldier. I was just glancing through this book by Michael Hunt called Ideology in U.S. Foreign Policy, and it really points out, I think, this paternalistic ideology of ours. It goes way back to the 19th century, and that's way back in American terms. And some of these cartoons in here are really priceless. There's this one guy thrashing a Chinaman. He's holding him by his pigtail, and a cat of nine tails. We as a nation have always felt it our duty to sort of witness Christian civilization, Christian science, capitalism to the rest of the world, and to ram it down their damn throats, whether they want it or not. And we're willing to kill them if they don't see things our way.
Okay. Let's, again, get a response.
Well, I do have to say that one of the things I have learned is that it isn't just the United States. All empires have behaved this way. All empires have been paternalistic. The thing that was so shocking for me as a young man is that I was quite explicitly taught all through my public education is that we were different from other nations, that we weren't like the British Empire and the Spanish Empire and the Roman Empire. And I think it was that discovery that, in fact, we were just like them, which was so deeply disillusioning for me. But that being said, the caller makes a very, what is now an obvious point, although it wasn't then. You know, McKinley, I believe it was President McKinley at the time of the end of the Spanish-American War, when the Filipinos wanted their independence, but we wouldn't give it to them. We basically took them from being a Spanish colony to being an American colony. And what McKinley said was, we have to civilize and Christianize our little brown brothers, quote, unquote. Ignoring the fact that the Philippines had been Christian for about 300 years prior to this time. But that was, the American arrogance and blindness. And back to the earlier point that the gentleman made, what occurred to me to point out as he talks about how Americans seem to not like this, but somehow put up with it, somehow get sucked into the propaganda game. What I find amazing among the American people is that none of them have really, so few people have taken to heart the fact that of all of our political leaders of the last two generations, our own and the preceding one, look at among that group who actually fought in Vietnam. The children of Ronald Reagan did not fight in Vietnam. The children of George Bush did not fight in Vietnam. The sons-in-law of Richard Nixon did not fight in Vietnam. You can go through almost all of this stuff, and you'll find a few. Al Gore, Jr., the vice president, did go to Vietnam. One of Lyndon Johnson's sons-in-laws did go to Vietnam. Whatever else you want to say for Chuck Robb, I admire the fact that he, in fact, was willing to do that. Most of these politicians' children skirted the war, and now we have my generation that is taking the reins of power. Phil Graham never served in Vietnam, never served in a military uniform. Newt Gingrich never served in a military uniform, let alone in Vietnam. You know, the people who send us off to fight wars do not fight those wars. For the most part, this has always been true, and yet they can stand up in front of the American people and flap their lips about how we have to fight this war or else, and send other people's children off to die And other people don't seem to notice this. It really baffles me.
Let's talk again with someone else in Cicero, Indiana. This is line two. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. Mr. Everhart?
Earhart.
Fairhart?
Yes.
I'm sorry. Your preceding comments, I think, paves the way for a question I have for you. And if you would please comment on three pretty central figures. You've already mentioned Robert McNamara and just then George Bush. And I would also include retired Admiral Elmo Zumwalt. You recall Zumwalt was chief of naval operations,
yes,
and his son had died because of his exposure in the Mekong Delta because of the kind of chemicals that,
yes,
Elmo Zumwalt. Zumwalt, as I understand, is now doing something in Vietnam, and I'd like you to comment on that, if you would, please. And secondly, Robert McNamara, when he was on his book tour, went to the Harvard Government Center, and a woman had gone there and asked, was at, waiting, we heard this on NPR, waiting for a apology from McNamara. And I think that he never did really apologize. And the second thing that Robert McNamara never did was say, all the proceeds from this book are going to go to Vietnam vets. And I thought that, I mean, if someone asked him that, and he says, well, I really don't know. I'd like to hear your comment on that. And secondly, George Bush just wrapped up his tour, and he maintains that that the United States government policy was right in doing what had gone on in Vietnam, which I thought was pretty incredible. And if you would feel comfortable commenting on it, I'll just hang up and listen. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call.
Well, yeah, McNamara, I mean, I can't even begin to express the level of contempt I have for the men who dragged us into the Vietnam War and kept us there all those many years and then basically walked away from the wreckage and never looked back. And McNamara, I think, actually has had troubled dreams ever since then. His conscience has bothered him, which is saying something for the guy, because obviously Henry Kissinger's conscience doesn't bother him. Dean Rusk went to his grave convinced that the only mistake he made was miscalculating the will of the American people to stay the course. That, you know, McNamara does have, there's some kind of a conscience in there. But unfortunately, it's not going to do him a whole lot of good because, as the caller pointed out, he still doesn't get it. If you actually listen to the man or read his book, I actually have not read the whole book. I refuse to give the guy any money or his editor or his publicist or any of those people. It's just more, you know, old white guys getting rich off other people's pain and suffering. But I have read enough of what was in Newsweek and heard a couple of his television presentations that it's perfectly clear the guy still doesn't understand what happened. And he has not actually said, you know, I'm sorry. And, of course, as far as the money goes, well, yeah, I mean, he's just, you know, an old white guy who's still getting rich off the war. Before he ever wrote his book, I hoped that he will rot in hell for all eternity, and I still hope that. Jesus is in the business of forgiveness, but I'm not, and I don't think you just forgive somebody for the millions and millions of lives. So that's what I think of McNamara. I hope he rots in hell forever. And George Bush, I mean, I don't know what to say about that guy. You would think that a guy who had actually been in combat himself would have a little better sense about it, but I don't know how much of that had to do with the fact that he was a pilot and didn't actually have to go and, you know, blow somebody's brains out. And I don't know what to make of George Bush. I do have to say that I didn't much like his politics, and it was clear to me that much of the driving force for his response to Iraq was this terrible need to wipe away the stain of Vietnam as George Bush and his cohorts perceived it, this terrible public humiliation that we had received in Vietnam. And he was going to make sure that that was, you know, erased from the American consciousness. He was going to make good. And, of course, if you look at his speeches as early as September of 1990, right on through to his remark in the wake of the war, how we have finally buried the ghost of the Vietnam War forever, words to that effect, that Now, it's clear that all these guys have been grinding their teeth ever since April 30th, 1975, to make up for that terrible humiliation that they perceive we suffered.
And it seems that it, when you take, as you mentioned earlier, when you take a look at the way people, many people reacted to this summer when we normalized relations with Vietnam, it seems pretty clear that the ghost is not gone.
Yes, that was the thing that the Gulf War didn't quite do what Bush wanted it to do, but it is very clear to look at his public pronouncements that he did want that he and a lot of other people. I mean, you know, we've talked about for two decades this notion of Vietnam syndrome. What Vietnam syndrome actually means to the people inside the Washington Beltway is the reluctance of the American people to countenance the introduction of the sending of their kids to die in foreign countries. Up until the Vietnam War, the U.S. government had pretty much free license to send American soldiers anywhere in the world to do whatever they wanted them to do. And people didn't object to that projection of military might. After Vietnam, people got very skeptical about that sort of thing. And you can see this gradual process through the 1980s of foreign policy establishment reaching out, trying to re-legitimize the use of American military force in foreign countries. You had the little invasion of Grenada, followed by the Panama thing, and then finally Desert Storm. And I think it was a very deliberate and concerted effort to re-legitimize American military intervention. It has only worked partially. The Gulf War did not have quite the stunning effect that folks in Washington would have liked it to have, because it became fairly clear in the wake of the Gulf War that this guy wasn't the next Adolf Hitler, and all of that, you know, all of that rhetoric that was used, that it was really not all that much to crow about, and the skepticism to a large degree still remains. But that's, I think, one of the main driving forces for the Gulf War was to finally eradicate that natural break, brake, on the government's use of American military might.
We have a couple of minutes left, and the lines are full, and unfortunately, pretty soon here, we're going to have to stop.
And I keep giving these long-winded answers.
Well, you know, I don't know.
Sound bites.
Well, see, we don't really traffic in sound bites here, so that's okay. And maybe what we should say is, we can have you back on another day. If I could keep you for another hour, I would, but I can't do that. Maybe, though, I can get one more caller in here. We'll go to Crystal Lake, line 4. Hello.
Yeah.
And we'll have to ask you to be brief because we don't have very much time.
I wish the war with Vietnam would teach people to keep out of any other wars like Bosnia, and they're all for control of companies, for the acquisition of resources. And I wish that our country would get rid of the landmines in Vietnam that destroy the lives of many people there. Instead, we're still making landmines in this country to sell to other countries. And it blows up farmers when they go into their fields and they lose an arm or a leg or their life. And I think that even the South Koreans didn't really want that war. And any of those that objected to the war, our CIA, with the help of some natives, did annihilate many South Koreans. And I think that the war in Vietnam, I wish it would still continue to teach us to keep out of any other country, whether it's a so-called drug war or what, it's all a fake, and we don't need some wars, of course, to get rid of population like in Rwanda, but it's also to get control of their beautiful land. But I do appreciate that many Vietnamese can led really to the saying that this country didn't want war, and we won't have war when we object to it if enough people think.
Okay.
Well, I wish all your wishes will come true, ma'am.
Do you, I'm really sad, I'll sort of apologize that we actually haven't got a chance to talk about Busted. but I guess one question that arises out of that, and I won't go into what the story's all about because I don't want to take the time to do that, but I guess the question that I want to ask is something like, do you sort of feel like now forever, as long as you live, that sort of everything that happens to you
you're going to measure against, you know, that the experience in Vietnam and what happened to you and what you did there is somehow a measuring stick that everything else gets measured to in some way?
Well, unfortunately, that does appear to be the case. I don't know how to get around it. Certainly everything since the 17th year of my life has been thrown through that prism. I simply cannot look at any aspect of my adult life that is not in some way affected by that experience. I guess the answer to your question is yes. I mean, it's a bit like saying, I can remember my parents' generation boring me to tears with their stories of the Great Depression and I had to save, you know, paper grocery bags and stuff like that. My mother couldn't throw away anything. And I'd go, oh, man, you know, do I have to hear you? Yeah, I know, Mom. You stuffed your shoes with newspaper, and it was a tough life. But I know now why that was, because it shaped who she was. You know, that experience, the Depression, was the molding experience for anyone who came of age in those years. And for me, the war in Vietnam and its consequences have shaped my life for better or worse. Sometimes I think it's the worst thing that could ever have happened to me. Sometimes I think that the Vietnam War destroyed my life because it's always there. And other times I just think, hey, that's life. You know, that's the way it goes. That's what I have to live with.
We've got to stop there. I want to thank you, Bill, very much for talking with us.
Well, thanks for having me on. It's been a pleasure.
And perhaps on another day we can talk some more. And again, for people who want to look for the most recent book, it's entitled Busted, A Vietnam Veteran in Nixon's America, published by University of Massachusetts Press by W.D. Earhart.